Unreasonable Women, a Modest Proposal, dedicated to the indigenous women of Nigeria who took on Chevron and won. Dedicated also to bearing witness. If the news gets too depressing and you feel you can't go on, take off your clothes, and circle the Pentagon. If the government annoys you and you don't know what to do, take off your clothes, and circle the White House too.
Thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next is Dr. Sonia Luberminsky on The Myths of Happiness. She talks with Tom Hartman about how many of us buy into the common myths about happiness and how we often end up feeling that we're destined always to be unhappy.
Wow. Yeah, it's a big question. You know, clearly our childhood does affect our adulthood. You know, in my book, I talk a lot about kind of how we think about the past. Do we have regrets about the past? Do we kind of dwell and ruminate about it? And I think people who are resilient kind of, they get past it. You know, some of them feel that they have grown as a result of their maybe past adverse or traumatic experiences. So maybe you've had a bad childhood, but you were able to overcome it. And you're able to find out sort of who your true friends are and what really matters. And so they have kind of a like a growth story. I mean, there's research on redemption. They have sort of a redemption story that they tell themselves. They were redeemed. But, you know, some people kind of dwell and ruminate, and they just can't get out of that. They get kind of stuck in the past, which is not a productive strategy. So a lot of, I think, I guess the success of the adult of adults and being resilient is sort of how you think about your past. I have a whole chapter about regrets. You know, 90% of us have regrets. And so how do we deal with regrets? Do we kind of dwell on them? Do we let them interfere with our sort of life? Or do we kind of come to terms with them? There's research that shows that people who are able to kind of confront and accept and kind of integrate their regrets into their identities actually become happier and more complex and even more mature as individuals.
So that's a matter of essentially regulating the stories that you tell yourself about yourself, like in the Kauai study. The kids who told themselves that they were victims were more likely to be fragile. The children who told themselves that, you know, stuff happens and I grew out of that, or I rose above it, were more likely to be resilient. And there's been this debate for 40 years about whether the stories evolved and produced the resilience, or the resilience came out of the stories. How does that work? And what's your suggestion to people who may feel like they're a little fragile? How do they become more resilient in terms of getting control of their own stories?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I actually was just hearing about some new research about the stories that we tell ourselves. This sort of shows that we can actually kind of manipulate those stories, that we can try to construct more kind of redemptive stories about our life and more kind of growth stories, like I have grown, as opposed to, you know, this is a bad experience that sort of, you know, changed me for the worse forever. And so there is sort of research that shows that we do have some control over the stories that we tell ourselves. I should say this research really is at its infancy, but I think it's really fascinating because I think we all tell stories about ourselves and about other people. They're really, really critical to our well-being and to our health as well.
I agree. I'm curious about your story. What caused you to want to investigate happiness?
Well, it's a good question, actually. You know, I went to Stanford University for my PhD, and on the very first day of grad school, I met with my advisor, whose name is Lee Ross, and he's one of the world's experts on conflict and negotiation. So, not very relevant to happiness. But at our first meeting, we just started talking about what is happiness and why are some people happier than others. And at that time, only one researcher in psychology, Ed Diener, was doing research on happiness, and it was sort of considered this very fuzzy kind of unscientific field. In fact, Diener didn't even use the word happiness. He called it subjective well-being.
Right.
It just sort of sounded more scientific. And so that's kind of what started. It was serendipitous. But, you know, happiness is really the holy grail. I mean, most people in the world say they want to be happy. Most people are interested in happiness. And so I'm just been, it's been a great field to be in for all these years.
What has been your methodology? How have you been investigating this?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, first of all, we have to measure happiness, and there's no thermometer of happiness, so we just ask people whether they're happy and how satisfied they are with their lives and how frequently they experience positive and negative emotions. But mostly what I do are called happiness interventions. So these are basically experimental studies that are done over time. They're kind of like clinical trials, but instead of testing a new treatment or a new drug, we're testing happiness strategies. So we might ask people, for example, do 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 acts of kindness this week, and then we ask them to do the same thing next week and the week after, and we show that people get happier when they do acts of kindness. Or we ask people to write gratitude letters, say once a week over a period of 6 or 8 or 10 weeks, and then we track their happiness over time. So we essentially do what are called positive or happiness interventions.
I had a cab driver last night. I said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "I'm great. My prayer every day starts with thank you." And I thought, what a great strategy.
Gratitude is so powerful. So much research that shows that people who are more grateful are happier, healthier, less materialistic.
That's marvelous. We'll be back. More of tonight's Conversations with Great Minds with Dr. Sonia Lyubomirsky coming up right after the break.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Have mercy upon them, Jah, for they know not what they do. Oh, they don't know what they do. They spread them lies and propaganda around the world. Politicians mouth the King of Kings. Still I and I will glorify Rastafari. Hey, the ever-living King. They spread them lies and propaganda around the world. Politicians mouth the King of Kings. Still I and I will glorify Rastafari. Hey, the ever-living King. For is the power of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Divine Spirit who created all things. He's the naturalistic, he's majestic, he's prophetic, he's the ever-burning fire, he's life in all things. For is the Lamb, and he's the Lion, he's from Zion, with the scepter in his hand, he's here to run all things. He's the rightful ruler of the earth, and he comes first, he holds the book of life, and holds the destiny of all things. They spread them lies and propaganda around the world. Politicians call the King of Kings. Still I and I will go retire as the far right.
Welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds with Dr. Sonia Lyubomirsky. She's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Received her AB from Harvard University, her PhD in social personality psychology from Stanford University, and is the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Myths of Happiness. Let's get back to it. You mentioned, just as we were about to hit the break there in our last segment, how you were suggesting that people write gratitude letters or thanks letters and acknowledge thanks, things like that. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when the Boy Scout mandate, I guess it was that you had to do a good deed every day. And I remember finding this particularly difficult, that the definition of a good deed, and I think this changed probably in the 60s or 70s, but I was, you know, a Boy Scout in the late 50s, early 60s, was that it is something that you do that benefits another person and they never know that you did it. I'm curious your thoughts on how, you know, what we might have lost by just losing that Boy Scout and presumably Girl Scout, ancient wisdom, it seemed to me.
Well, I hope that we haven't lost it. I mean, there's still a value that we should be kind and generous to others. And so, as I mentioned before, I've done lots of studies showing that people who do acts of kindness become happier. And in fact, we just finished a study in the Vancouver middle schools with 4th, 5th, and 6th grade children. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is we found that kids who did acts of kindness every week for 6 weeks, not only did they get happier, but they became more popular with their peers, with their classmates, even though the acts of kindness were mostly done at home, I believe. Somehow it rubbed off on them. Now, I think, you know, doing anonymous acts of kindness is great. It makes you feel like a good person, but there's also benefits to doing acts of kindness that are not anonymous, because you have great social benefits as well. Lots and lots of research shows that these kind of good deeds are really important to do, and I hope we haven't lost that value.
Yeah, I agree. the conventional wisdom in the self-help literature, kind of all the way back to Dale Carnegie, is that it takes 3 weeks to change a habit, 21 days. Have you found that there is a period of time during which people practice some of the things that you're recommending in your book, and after which they become part of you, and if you stop before that point, it just kind of you just kind of bounce back to where you were?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm not, you know, there's researchers who study habits, and actually I read in one place that it took, I think, 11 weeks, so I guess different studies find different findings. I really think that it depends on the person, and so you have to kind of find out what that critical time period for you to change a habit. We have not done enough studies or enough long-term studies to really identify kind of that magic number, how long does it take, but clearly practice over time is really important. In fact, one of the themes of my research is that you really have to put the work in it, you know, and to change a habit, as we all know, is really hard. It takes a lot of work, energy, maybe every day, every week for the rest of your life, you want to kind of work and maintain that habit.
Dr. Marty Seligman did some amazing research back in the 80s on learned helplessness that then led him into learned happiness in the 90s and things like this. To what extent is, in your research, is there a flip side to this where, you know, people can get into bad habits, into self-destructive habits, into creating fragility or losing happiness habits, and those can spiral out of control? And when that happens, what should they do?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I don't study the bad habits. I mean, I don't manipulate, you know, it would be unethical for me to kind of get people to try to...
Yeah, he was doing it with dogs.
Right, I know. And that study, it was some amazing studies he did. Those studies could probably not be done today, you know,
right,
for ethical reasons. But clearly there's a flip side. You know, you can learn, ineffective, you know, negative strategies just as well, just as easily, perhaps, as positive strategies. So we have to really watch ourselves. You know, one approach that I take for when I teach classes on happiness is I ask my students to keep kind of track of what they do, kind of keep a diary in a sense, and then you can sort of catch yourself, like, when are you most unhappy during the day, you know, what are you doing, and then try to do less of that.
One of the things that surprised me the most as a parent, I have three adult children now, was that I had always thought that temperament was a kind of shorthand for personality of the moment, but I've seen kids grow up and seen temperament that was there virtually at birth, and sometimes even, you know, kicking a lot in the womb, carry all the way into their 30s. To what extent does how do you define temperament, and to what extent does that influence happiness, and to what extent do we have control over our own temperament?
Mm-hmm. It's quite amazing. So my first book called The How of Happiness actually talked a lot about this. So you can think of temperament as essentially as personality. Just speaking of happiness, there's a strong genetic component to happiness. You know, when you have more than one kid, you notice some of them are just happier than others, and some of them are more extroverted than others, and some of them are more open to different kinds of experience than others. So there's a genetic component to personality and to happiness, and that's a fact. Now, that doesn't mean that we're doomed to be unhappy if our kind of our set point for happiness is low, or if we're doomed to, you know, I used to be very, very shy. I think that's my kind of genetic contribution, but I, with a lot of willpower over the course of many years, I became more and more extroverted. I think that's fairly unusual. People tend to kind of stay shy throughout their life, or stay happy or unhappy. But again, there's a part of our personality or part of our temperament that we can change through kind of force of will, through a lot of work, a lot of practice. Kind of like if your set point for weight is higher than you like, you're not doomed to be a fat person. You can lose weight, become fit, but it just takes a lot more work than if you're kind of a naturally skinny person. So those of us who are kind of unlucky to have a negative temperament, or temperament that we don't like, or other people don't like, we just have to put more work into changing it.
But it's still possible. That's great news. I'm curious what, you know, your research has been done entirely in the United States.
That's not true.
Oh, it's
not.
Okay. Then what have you learned about the impact or the intersection of culture and happiness?
Mm-hmm. Well, you may find this surprising, but we've actually done quite a few studies, especially recently, in South Korea, in Japan, and most recently in Spain. And we're not finding major cultural differences. I mean, we know they're there. I mean, there are obviously cultural differences. So there's a much more emphasis on happiness, for example, in the United States. We did do one study, actually, in the United States with Asian Americans. So these are individuals who were born in Asian countries and immigrated here. And we found that Asian Americans didn't benefit from our happiness interventions, like writing gratitude letters or trying to be more optimistic, as much as the European Americans. So maybe there was kind of less cultural support for that. So we did find that cultural difference. But when we've done our studies in South Korea and Japan, Spain, we have not actually found really many, if any, differences. I mean, when we just did a study in Spain where we had people do acts of kindness in the workplace, and it had incredible benefits, sort of it raised the morale of the entire office. Same thing in South Korea and Japan. So perhaps, you know, I think the pursuit of happiness is universal.
Yeah.
And the strategies that we study, being kind to others, being more positive, being more grateful, are fairly universal as well.
Japanese culture, it's been some years since I've seen the literature on this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that Japanese culture is more like most indigenous cultures in that one of the greatest cultural negatives is shame, whereas in most European cultures, the greatest cultural negative is embarrassment. Might that have something to do with it?
Well, you know, in a little while, I haven't studied really shame and embarrassment in my research, but we did just find, actually, we have a finding from South Korea, okay, not Japan, but another Asian culture, where we found that that expressing gratitude was a little bit more kind of conflicting or mixed for the South Koreans. And I think I wouldn't call it shame, but I think there's a feeling of kind of indebtedness.
Well, there's obligation. I mean, the Japanese is an obligation-based culture.
Right. So I think in some Asian cultures, expressing gratitude can have some kind of hedonic costs, so we have to be careful. We did find that, so maybe that has something to do with what you're talking about.
Well, since you brought it up, you want to describe hedonic adaptation?
Sure, hedonic adaptation, really important construct, concept that I talk a lot about in the myths of happiness. So adaptation is basically the phenomenon that human beings are remarkably good at getting used to changes in our lives. So, you know, when we get married, we have this boost in happiness. On average, that boost lasts for 2 years for the average person. When we get more money, you know, get a salary raise, that makes us happy, but then we just, you know, start wanting more. So adaptation is really important to consider, because a lot of people think like, oh, you know, my job isn't what it used to be. You know, I'm not as excited about it as I used to be, or my marriage isn't what it used to be. They think that there might be something wrong with their job or something wrong with their marriage, when really they're just experiencing a very human, kind of ordinary process of hedonic adaptation.
This is kind of the conventional story of when the honeymoon is over. Right.
That's right. You know, the honeymoon is over, and it happens for, you know, almost everyone. And so, again, what I say in my book is that it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, you know, because some people might make poor decisions. They might jettison when the honeymoon is over. They might think, oh, gee, you know, because in the media and movies and in literature and poetry, there's this ideal of romantic, passionate love. And when that doesn't last for us forever, we think, oh, I got to, you know, maybe there's something wrong with my partner. I got to get a new partner. So I think that's just a really important message.
I'm curious your thoughts on mindfulness, on being present. It seems that so many people who are caught in unhappiness are either obsessing on shame from the past or on fear of the future. And have you found that teaching people to bring themselves to the present moment and let go of that past or future can help happiness?
Yeah, absolutely. I think mindfulness is so important, very relevant to what I was talking about before, about the importance of attention, kind of what we can control, what we direct our attention to. In a sense, mindfulness is trying to do that. And, you know, when thoughts, kind of negative thoughts, say, come into your mind, you kind of let them go. And there's lots and lots of research on mindfulness meditation, different mindfulness techniques. People who use mindfulness techniques become happier, they become healthier. There's all kinds of good, you know, the relationships improve. I haven't specifically studied mindfulness myself, but I also have written about kind of living in the present moment. So the importance of kind of, as you said, you know, not focusing too much on the past or the future. Now, of course, there are times when we need to focus on the past or the future. Right, but focused on savoring the moment makes people happy as well.
There you go. Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And for writing this great book. Thank you.
Distant. disturbing visions of flag covered coffins each day. United we stand while they're warring our future away. The spin doctors dance while our young men continue to die. All for the sake of the corporate American pie. It's a conspiracy of silence. It's breaking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth won't be found. The president seems to have dangerous thoughts in his head. His warm-minded handlers are pushing him over the edge. Protecting the interests of all their industrial friends. The sins of the father repeating all over again. It's a conspiracy of silence that's taking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth can't be found. September 11th will justify all of your unjustifiable wars. It's a conspiracy. This time we demanded they answer the questions they've got. Make them return to us all of our freedoms they've robbed. The seeds of Big Brother have started to take root and spread. And if we don't rise up, we'll find our democracy's dead. It's a conspiracy of silence that's keeping us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth can't be found. That's a conspiracy of silence. It's tearing us down. The conspiracy of silence.
There's a big brown cloud in the city and the countryside to sin. The price of life is too high to give up. It's gotta come down again. But worldwide war is over and done, and the dream of peace comes true. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. When we find out how to burn water and the gasoline car is gone. When an airplane flies without any fuel and the sunlight heats our home. One of these days when the air clears up and the sun comes shining through, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. All right, Marky. You don't have to get high to get happy. Just think about what's in store. When people start doing what they ought to be doing, then they won't be booing no more. When a president goes through the White House door, does what he says he'll do. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue.
dragon free, bubble up and eat that rainbow stew.
Show me a prison, show me a jail, show me a prison man whose face is growing pale, and I'll show you a young man with many reasons why, and there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me an alley, show me a train, show me a hobo who sleeps out in the rain, and I'll show you a young man with many reasons why, and there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me the whiskey that stains on the floor, show me a drunken man as he stumbles out the door, and I'll show you a young man with many reasons why, and there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me a country where the bombs had to fall, show me the ruins of the buildings once so tall, and I'll show you a young land with so many reasons why, and there but for fortune may go you or I, or I.
That's all, folks.